You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for May 3rd, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the Rand Paul Ted Cruz Shelter-in-Place Grotto 2016. It's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Paul Ted Cruz 2016, because Jeb Bush isn't conservative enough.
That's right. And never will be. He never will be.
I just thought about that this morning that, yeah. Oh my gosh, we're because of Tweety, because of Chris Matthews, we can't stop talking about Hillary 2016, but maybe we should stop talking about Hillary 2016.
Yeah. Well, I'm
and just go through the Republican field.
By we, I assume you mean other people, because I'm perfectly happy to wait till 2015 to have this conversation.
Except that I think by rehearsing the field that is available for 2016, the presidential field, I think that actually helps us in 2014.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. If you vote Republican for your House member in 2014, you're actually associating with Ted Cruz.
No, you're not. You're voting against
Nancy Pelosi.
Come on, honey. Get with the program.
Nice try. Yeah. Nice try.
Yeah. Nobody's crazy enough to elect Rand Paul. Nobody's crazy enough to elect Ted Cruz. Really? Because being older than 12, as I am, the latter half of the 20th century and the early 21st is littered with people who are confident that some Republican
like
or another.
Ronald Reagan.
No, he's too crazy. George W. Bush is a moron. He's a dry, drunk idiot. Nobody takes him seriously. So this idea that so-and-so is too crazy or too stupid or too whatever.
You need to watch out.
Because you start off with 43, 44, 45% of the vote.
Who's going
out
to
of
vote
the box.
Are automatically.
Out of the box. Yeah. No matter who it is. Yep. These are people who would rather have burned their own tongue off with acid than say the name Mitt Romney, Republican candidate, before the last election.
Yep.
And they went out and voted for him. And they went out and they did a lot of heavy lifting. And frankly, this is what got me in trouble with liberal organizations I was affiliated with a long time ago. Not in trouble, but we came to loggerheads over – there were people there who were purity people, who were absolutist. You know, Bill Clinton might have given us back 75% of what Reagan took. But
he didn't give us 100%.
He didn't give
so
us
120. We have to fight for that 25%.
So he's worse than Reagan.
Wow.
Yeah. Because he's supposed to be on our side, and he betrayed us. And again,
there is a place for that if you are a lobbyist for
absolutely
food banks or Meals on Wheels or whatever it is.
Our world would be a poorer place without the gadflies, and I don't mean that in a dismissive way. Without people who prod us along in the right direction,
pushing to say this has to be the way it is, and then that's how they get that 75% is by being a-holes about their issue until it's something changes. Yeah.
This particular group, at least some of them looked askance at the idea I floated that we should maybe learn from Newt Gingrich.
Yeah.
We shouldn't become Newt Gingrich, but he had a successful strategy or successful tactics inside, outside. It was relentlessly demonize liberals and Democrats. Never stop talking about how bad they are.
We mentioned this last week.
Yeah. Get friends on the inside. Get the press to do it. Get your Rush Limbaugh to line up with you and just pound away at them and pound away at them until the idea of voting liberal is so horrifying that undecideds will never do it. They'd rather declare themselves independent, et cetera. And the people in that organization, not all of them, mind you, but the pure core were horrified.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do things like that. That's not who we are. Newt Gingrich is just evil. Let's focus on making sure Bill Clinton is powerless. But 20 years later, we sort of need to understand who we're fighting.
Yeah.
We can't pretend that just because they're hideously unqualified and incompetent, that means things are going to go our way. And we also have to not pretend that we can't screw it up all by ourselves.
No, absolutely. And I do want to reiterate what we said last week, which is the stupid party is at it again. The stupid party is at it again.
Yeah.
And really, when Ted Cruz or some other, even some state representative idiot opens his pie hole and makes a racist statement or a homophobic statement, or what was the one? There was someone in New Hampshire who said Jew up.
Jew down.
Jew down. We don't want to Jew down the prices. What? I didn't say anything. What did I say wrong? Yeah.
Oh, I apologize to the Jews. They're good business people. Ha, 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 ha.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, and there was the N-word rigging.
Yep.
And, you
need to make sure that in our language, politically speaking, that there is a blanket association of Republican candidates with that mind process, because Lindsey Graham is never going to speak out against those people.
No. And that's what you're asking them
to do. And that's what you're asking him to do.
Asking him to say.
You think it's all right for someone to say N-word whatever or Jew down or what? Do you think those are okay things to say?
And those are just the tip of the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, tip of the iceberg. Speaking of incompetent.
Yeah.
Ed Henry.
Yeah.
At the president's press conference this week, he got a question in.
He did, as Ed Henry is wont to do.
And
you want to tell people who Ed Henry is?
Ed Henry works for Fox News.
Yeah, he's got a very large head.
He does, he's
well fed.
Well fed and well taken care of by. Yes. I mean that if I had been, it's a good thing I'm not president of the United States. I know you
too.
The same way.
Absolutely.
But I would have gone after it. Ed Henry had to burst out with a Benghazi question because that was his job.
Right.
And I would have just stopped the press conference at that point and said, Ed, I really need to talk to you.
Yeah.
Person to person, as a friend, as somebody who wants you to have a career in journalism.
Uh-huh.
You realize that your network is going to die someday. And you realize that once Rupert's gone, his heirs are not going to play along with, because there's no money left in it. The average age of the Fox News viewer is dead, as Jon Stewart said, as you quoted Jon Stewart. So, Ed, for your own sake, save yourself. And you'll have a lot of nervous laughter around Ed Henry at that point.
Yeah.
And say, look around you, Ed. Which news organization is going to hire you when they're done?
NBC.
That would be his answer.
CNN. Pretty much all of them.
Talking on Meet the Press, no problem.
Look, Ed, you ever see the end? You ever see One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Ed?
Yeah.
That last thing where the chief smothers him because he's brain dead. That's pretty much your news network.
That's your news network right there.
And you're still crank along on momentum. There's a lot of 94-year-old people who are not very aware of their surroundings, who think that you're doing a pretty good job, but they're heading towards the demographic area we call no longer living Americans.
Graveyard, yes.
And so after that happens, I assume you have saved your money and you've made big plans, because really.
I want to do a shout out to Crystal Ball from NBC. Yeah. Her tweet was the funniest tweet of the week.
Uh-huh.
Why is Ed Henry ignoring Fast and Furious? All right.
which is all. Well, and let's swing this around to Pat Toomey.
Yeah.
Shall we?
Go ahead. You had lot to say about him this morning.
Well, it has a lot to do with everything we've sort of set up to the present moment, which is this fantasy that we're playing an entirely different game than we're playing. Uh-huh. This Maureen Dowdish illusion, this delusion, that if only the president had more leadership, if only he were more like a fictional character in one of my favorite movies, then everything would work out.
He wasn't so polarizing.
Exactly. Girl. Black. If you weren't so black. If only you weren't so darn black.
That's what they mean.
And urban and democratic and black. And, you know, we're sitting, the liberals on the sideline, even the ones who think I'm an awful, awful person and sellout, we're sitting over here going, dude, he's a Eisenhower Republican.
Yeah.
He's radical in any way, it's sad
how not liberal he is. We've known this since 2007.
But the game is convincing 50.1% of the country that anyone with a D after their name is a bomb throwing communist.
Well, in some respects, Drift Glass, I will say this.
Uh-huh.
Rachel Maddow said this, much to her credit, this week, and it's straight out of her book too.
Uh-huh.
Obama has solidified executive power when it comes to Gitmo and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
He has amplified what Bush did.
Yes, he has.
And that is horrible. That's a horrible thing. So to pretend that he is, like you say, a radical bomb throwing communist usurper who wants to destroy America
is hilarious.
It's hilarious.
Or to quote the man himself, he's not the strapping
socialist. Did you catch that word strapping?
Yeah, I sure did. Little dog whistle blown for comedic effect. And he's not that guy. He's not the socialist Kenyan that he used to be and never was. You can walk his career all the way back to being 20 miles from our house in the state legislature playing poker with Republicans. He's never been anything other than what he is now, ever. He's never been. But he has been consistently better than the people that he has been opposing.
But Pat Toomey,
I would have said 3 or 4 years ago, when every liberal, including me, was writing indignantly about, why do you keep letting these people stomp on you? Mm-hmm. Why do you keep hanging your chin out there when they're going to do nothing but oppose you? Don't you understand what malevolent fuckers these are? They're never going to give you anything. Get over it and move on and shift your strategy. If Pat Toomey had said this 4 years ago, 5 years ago, you could say he was giving the game away. But the game's already given away. Yeah. Everyone knows. Everyone but David Gregory knows what's going on in Washington, D.C. And David Gregory knows fucking full well.
Well, David Gregory lies about it.
He just lies about it. And as do Maureen Dowd and Tom Brokaw and all the rest of the waxworks figures that populate the Sunday shows. Because the minute, as we've said a million times, the minute they're required to say, no, the real problem with D.C., the immediate short-term problem is the Republican Party. Democrats have all the faults in the world, and we can spend hours naming them. But the real carcinoma that's killing our process is the Republican Party, period. The minute they say that, they're canceled, they're off the air, and they'll put Ed Henry on in his place.
And he'll say whatever he's told to say, including Benghazi, which, by the way, the only bigger dead horse, someone said on Twitter, the only bigger dead horse than Benghazi is the GOP, if only.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and this is, you know, this is just a series of going back to Acorn and going back to
they're throwing jello against the wall to see what will stick, you know, constantly. Yeah.
And you shoot enough voltage into a dead frog, it'll twitch.
Yeah.
It'll twitch all the way to the polls and it'll vote for you. But that doesn't mean it's alive or thinking or its opinion should be valued or validated by putting it on the air. Speaking of CNN and New King.
Yeah.
Anyway,
the quote from Pat Toomey.
Pat Toomey said, in the end, it didn't pass. And this, we're talking about expanding the background checks.
Background checks.
We're talking about the most tepid, little,
watered down
wimpy, baby step.
Yeah.
You could possibly do on gun control. The least you could possibly do without doing absolutely nothing is background checks. Went down to defeat because Republicans opposed the bill out of a desire to deny the president a victory. And here's what Pat Toomey said. In the end, it didn't pass because we're so politicized. There were some on my side who did not want to be seen helping the president do something he wanted to get done just because the president wanted to do it. If he's in favor of it, they will oppose it. Mm-hmm. Even if it's their own bill, even if it helps veterans, even if it has been co-authored, even if it's their own climate change idea, even if it's their own healthcare bill. I cannot repeat this often enough. It's boring, I know, but the Republican Party is the problem. That does not mean the Democratic Party is populated by saints at all. Yeah. It means that if you would like to focus on the number one problem that is affecting more problems than anything else, that has more interstitial touch points to more problems than anything else, you need to focus on the screwed up Republican Party and the completely craven centrists who get paid an awful lot of money to say, but both sides do it, but liberals are worse. But isn't it true that liberals do the same thing every fucking time you find that the Republican Party doing something, publicly admitting, yeah, this is our strategy. We're giving them nothing. And
I found it fascinating that and I'm sure some people in John Stewart's staff were writing the speech that Obama gave at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, because they do.
Yeah.
However, the fact that he used humor to say two things that really needed to be said. One was about CNN and balance. And the other was about drink with Mitch McConnell. You have a drink with him.
Yeah.
And everyone laughed, and it wasn't nervous laughter. It was acknowledging. Yeah, like I'm going to work with this guy.
It was acknowledging what everyone knows.
Everyone knows.
And everyone knows, but no one will say.
Yep.
And we have a couple of examples later on in the podcast, Rahm Emanuel and Sandra Day O'Connor, that might be.
Go ahead and go into that right now.
You want to jump into that now?
Right now.
Okay. Well, Rahm Emanuel, as you know, is the new mayor of the city of Chicago, the great city of Chicago. And Rahm Emanuel has just tried to modify what was essentially a massive looting of the treasury of the city of Chicago by the former mayor mm-hmm. on behalf of the most incestuous interlinking relationships you're ever going to want to find. The Chicago essentially sold its parking meters to a private company through Morgan Stanley, where Daley's son works and where his former press secretary went to work. It sold them at a leased them for 99 years, but effectively sold them for a fraction of what they were worth, rammed them through this rubber stamp city council that did whatever Daley told them to do. And everybody knew it was going to be gone. Everybody, this is going to be a rainy day fund. It's going to last for years. No. The city of Chicago had sold the Skyway on exactly the same premises, that it was going to be a rainy day fund. It was going to be around forever. A few years later, the money's all gone. And the money was going because the money was evaporating because Richie Daley built political peace by bribing people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He paid off. I mean, it's all legal bribery, but he basically committed to doing everything and throw money at every problem and hire anybody who he needs to hire away from anybody else. And labor problems, we'll just promise him a bunch of shit down the road and that'll take care of it. And he made a bunch of promises that were all based on an infinite supply of city revenue going up forever. And when that started to when revenue started to fall behind promises, Daley started selling off assets instead of doing the responsible thing of saying, you know, we're living beyond our means. We need to cut back. We need to reallocate. We need to do some smart things they do in corporate America, which he worships. He just started selling off assets. And then the economy tanked. And then he lost the Olympics. And suddenly he's like a junkie without any scratch. So he starts taking shit to the pawn shop and pawning it. Everybody knew the parking meter deal, which essentially sold the meters to a consortium
private
of companies,
yep.
Dubai holders. Mm-hmm. You know, these are foreigners. And what they will recoup in that sale vastly exceeds the $1 billion Daley sold it for, which is long since gone.
The city spent that money. That was supposed to be their rainy day fund for a decade.
It propped up the last year and a half of the Daley administration.
Daley's administration, then it was gone.
And then it was gone. And then he mysteriously decided to leave. He didn't want to be mayor
Go work in China for.
And now he works. Obviously. No, now he works for the company that brokered the deal. He works for the company. He's
on the board of everything, actually. Yeah.
But he's getting paid as off counsel for the company that cut the deal together.
Wow.
But the thing is, this is the important thing. Everyone knew the deal was.
Everyone knew this. Yeah.
Everyone, except nobody said it.
Yep.
There were a couple of reporters, Jurasky and Dumke, Mike Dumke and Ben Jurasky, who worked for the Readers. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing their names a little bit. Matt Taibbi and me were pretty much the only people at the time who were saying this deal stinks. It stinks to high heaven. It is completely rife with the incestuous bullshit. The money's never going to be set aside for a rainy day fund. It's all going to be spent to prop up this dictator in this one party, one party despot during the last year of his administration, so he can go out in a blaze of glory, and then he's going to dump the problem on other people and walk out the door. Everybody knew it. Nobody said it. Well, here we are a few years later. Rahm Emanuel's now mayor, and Rahm Emanuel's trying to modify the deal. He got some small changes, but not many. What does Mayor Rahm Emanuel say that Rahm Emanuel, private citizen and friend of the Daley family and former congressman from Illinois and former chief of staff of the White House, never said. Fucking said at the time. He said now this deal should never have been done.
Yep. It's a bad deal.
Terrible idea. And we're stuck with it. So we're going to modify it however we can. But at the time, he didn't have the balls to say it. Nobody had the balls to say it because
he didn't say it when he ran for office. No, he didn't say it was a bad deal.
You can't, because to say that is to say that Daley was wrong.
Yeah,
and very much like a centrist, like David Gregory, you can't say things, certain things. You can't say the Republicans are the problem or you lose your job. You can't say Daley was fucking crazy and wrong and blew through all that money for rotten reasons and rigged up an incestuous deal that enriched his friends and ever hope to win a political office in Chicago until he's gone. Mm-hmm. So which brings us to Sandra Day O'Connor. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Remember that little thing they had in Florida where George Bush won the presidency 5-4 on the Supreme Court, where the party of states' rights applauded the ripping the election out of the hands of the state so it could go up to the Supreme Court.
And the state applauded it because it was the result that all the state officials in Florida wanted anyway.
All the officials who all worked on the Bush campaign, who all helped him run, who ran his organization, were the same people who were counting the votes. we need not relitigate that now. But it was a really grotesquely politically botched decision that has really tainted this country ever since. I mean, it's an election. He won. He was sworn in. I was there. There was a concession speech. But everyone knows that this just stank. It fucking stank. Well, one of the people who was appointed by Ronald Reagan, if memory serves me correctly, who sided with Bush in Bush v. Gore, was named Sandra Day O'Connor, who long after it was too late to do anything.
This week, as a matter of fact, said,
you know, maybe that wasn't such a good idea. Maybe that we shouldn't have taken that decision away from the state. You know, maybe we should have, because it really kind of reflected badly on the reputation of the court. Maybe this wasn't such a, oh, well, I'm retired now, so who the fuck cares? And again, there's a long list of people. Sandra Day O'Connor, Rahm Emanuel, I would include Ken Mellman on that list, who worked his heart out for a rabidly anti-gay party, pushing a rabidly anti-gay agenda as a closeted gay man, and suddenly discovered the fact that he was working for people who hated and wanted to eliminate him after he left his high-paying job. Michael Steele, frontman for the hardest-working white party in America, suddenly discovered his blackness and suddenly discovered this long history of Republican racism after he left the Republican Party.
And even still.
He's still an apologist. He's still a stooge. Yeah. But he only discovered his courage once it became no longer part of his job description to lie about the past. And
I want to add a couple people to that list.
Oh, yeah, please, please.
Don't mind, because I am very worried about the Hillary Clinton campaign coming up and the fact that we're going to have to listen to and applaud with Tina Brown and Arianna Huffington and this whole boomer success ramp of Soho loft dwelling denizens. And it makes me want to hug the porcelain throne and just barf.
We're going to have to live with Mark Penn again.
Well, I don't think she's going to be that stupid, because even David Gregory said she shouldn't hire Mark Penn. Yeah. But we're going to have Tina Brown next to her applauding and, you know, introducing her around and singing her praise. And to me, the early part of Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2008 sealed her doom, because she insulated herself with boomer women who liked the same things she liked. And so we had the Celine Dion song and the Hillary for you and me, up with people stuff going on. And just, you know, she's entitled to her taste, but she's got to youth it up a little bit. Youth, Y-O-U-T-H.
Yeah. Well, and you've talked in a few previous podcasts, you've alluded to in a few previous podcasts, sort of the missing generation in American politics, which is our generation.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially,
Well, we went into comedy. Who was the guy who was on the other night saying he was our age? It was, Stephen Colbert's our age and Jon Stewart's our age. And there was someone else who said, Robert Downey Jr., wasn't it?
Robert Downey Jr.
But there were the
boomer. My sister is a boomer. I love her dearly, and she's wonderful. And so I'm not slighting an entire generation, but there, this boomer ethos of acquiring leadership,
and feeling entitled to it,
but then looking for your proteges in the grandchildren.
Yep. Yep.
Like, wait a minute. You have an entire generation of people who have been
of women, and particularly especially
women.
This is the amazing thing. It's Hillary looking at Chelsea as the future of America when Chelsea's in her 20s.
Right.
And there are 50-year-old women ready to run for office. Their kids are grown or in high school or whatever. They're ready to take on responsibility and run. And they are just completely looked over to. No, we are mentoring our grandchildren, and it's just or young children or 20-something children, because that's the future. And it's going to be bad, because there's going to be a die-off in progressive politics.
Yeah, of course there is.
And we're not nurturing the people who can jump right in and fill that hole, and we're not doing that. So this is an anniversary for Harold Washington in Chicago.
It is.
Also, speaking of Chicago,
have my Harold Washington campaign button.
Do you really?
Yeah, I do.
What's the anniversary? Is it the anniversary of his election?
The 30th anniversary of his election.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
30 years ago this week, he was sworn in as mayor. Hmm. Uh-huh. And There's a lot.
There's an article out about that.
There are several. There are a bunch of them. I read through a few of them. Salim Muakil, who's a writer for The Progressive in Chicago, good, very good writer. You see him on Channel 11 a lot. And a bunch of other people are writing about Harold and his legacy and sort of how Harold Washington's existence drew Barack Obama to Chicago and how Barack Obama sort of took over the remnants of the Washington Coalition. Mm-hmm. They helped him become a state senator and then on to become senator and president. All of which is true. But the most interesting part of I think Harold Washington is a fascinating character because he's a machine politician. He came up with he came up as a typical machine hack. Not to say he wasn't brilliant and he couldn't debate the hell out of everybody around him. He was the smartest guy in the room every room he went in. But he was a machine politician who found room between two Democratic candidates, Jane Byrne and young state's attorney Richie Daley, to run up the middle and be the smart guy in the room. And he won the Democratic primary. And with some little help from the Reader, which, as I recall, didn't report on what Daley said or thought he said, reported on his actual words that he used in the debate. And Richie Daley had never had a comfortable relationship with the English language. And it sounded like an idiot during the debate. So Harold won the primary. And immediately after that, hundreds of thousands of ethnic white Chicagoans inflamed by
your people, Driftglass.
My people. Irish and Polish and Italian, you know, ethnic whites in Chicago fled the Democratic Party. These people are people who have been taught at their mother's breast to vote straight Democratic Party, or the alderman won't come at Christmas and bring you your ham. You know, it's a machine. This is machine politics in its final days. These people fled and voted for a guy named Bernie Epton, a Republican. They voted for a fucking Republican because they couldn't bring themselves to vote for a black guy. That's lesson number one. Lesson number two, a guy named Eddie Verdoliak and Ed Burke as well created a coalition, a majority coalition in the Chicago City Council. The Chicago City Council had been a rubber stamp for Richard Daley, Daley the First, during his entire administration, giving him everything he wanted. He was a rubber stamp. Give the mayor what he or she wants right up until the black guy was elected. And at that point, Eddie Verdoliak created what was called the Verdoliak 29 that systematically blocked every single thing Harold Washington tried to do.
Oh, gee, this sounds so familiar. You know, I really think the problem with Harold Washington, though, Driftglass,
yeah,
is that he was so polarizing.
He was a polarizing
black
man.
And he really didn't lead.
And there was, the real failure in Chicago media is, we didn't have like a Maureen Dowd in the Chicago newspaper
to lecture
him on how he should be a better leader. There's this fictional movie I remember from the 90s where you could be like that guy. And the reporters who were writing were people like Mike Royko.
Yeah.
And even the bad reporters weren't stupid enough to pretend that this was like both sides doing
right,
it.
Right, right.
It was,
right.
No, a whole bunch of racist white assholes have formed a coalition to make the city ungovernable.
Stop this city from being governed. Exactly.
And because Washington not only committed the sin of being black, but he was a coalition-building politician who also promised to more equitably distribute city
funds to other people. To those people.
Yeah. And the white power structure couldn't stand for that. So they formed a coalition, and they did just two or three things real quick. They forced Harold Washington to keep the city running by mayoral edict, basically, and then accused him of being a dictator. They made the city ungovernable and then attacked him for not being a coalition building person who would reach out to people and ran against his lack of leadership. Now, this all sounds like hideously familiar. It's because 30 years later, this is exactly the same strategy the right wing Republicans are using very effectively against Barack Obama. The thing that I cannot figure out, the thing that the cardinal disappointment that I've had with Barack Obama,
Know ahead of time.
Other than his refusal to stop droning people.
Yeah.
And things like that, is his inexplicable inability to learn the Harold Washington lesson, despite the fact that he came up in the
Harold Chicago. He knows this.
From Chicago. He knows all this shit.
Yes, yes.
But I guess he thought he was more charming or more persuasive or whatever.
Yeah, or that there would be collegiality in the Senate. Yes, yeah. Whatever.
And he didn't figure out what every fucking liberal, including you and me, tried to tell him day one. These people are going to do anything they can to destroy you. You are Bill Clinton, except you're black, which makes you infinitely worse.
Yep.
They impeached him, dude. What do you think they're going to do to you?
Yeah.
And he wasted years of valuable time pretending that Republicans weren't obstructionist assholes. And now he's finally sort of come around to that point of view. But Harold figured it out right away.
Yeah.
And Harold would go on the news and call out Ed Verdoliak by name.
Yeah.
And that's something that Obama just can't do or could never do.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the history. So longer post at my place later today.
Well, and I think part of it has to do with him being the first black president, whereas black mayors have happened, not in Chicago.
Chicago, baby. No.
Someone begged us to talk about Howie Kurtz today and how Howie Kurtz and Tina Brown have parted ways over the gay basketball player.
You want to go ahead and take this one, Blue? I'll have it add my 2 cents, but.
Well, I just, mom said if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything. I don't care about Howie Kurtz, and he will always land on his feet, and his wife's a millionaire, so screw that. And then Tina Brown, as we've talked about before, she's really interested in packaging her product for advertisers, not for the public, not for the truth, not for what is going to be good for journalism, but what's going to sell.
And
what sells is centrism.
You saw her on.
Oh, she was at Blogger, and I went to breakfast where she was giving this, she was on this blonde panel of marketing writing type people. It was obscene.
Yeah.
And the wonderful thing about that weekend was, number one, meeting the women from Evil Slut Click, who were they're really great bloggers.
Yeah.
And secondly, they had scholarship winners from overseas that they had brought to blog her, who were social activists and who were writing and blogging for the absolute poorest people on the planet. And there were four of them there, and they were from third world countries, and they were absolutely writing for indigenous people, advocating for indigenous people. And it just made, I stood up and cried in the audience because I said, I didn't say this, but I said, look, you have a breakfast where you have everybody come and we have to listen to fucking Tina Brown talking about wrapping the ads around content. And then on, Sunday afternoon, you have these women come up and there's 20 people in this room listening to this. This is bullshit.
Yep.
I didn't put it that way, but I did say why.
You did afterwards, because I remember.
I did. I blogged about it afterwards. Yeah.
Well, you and I were,
Yeah, I was on the phone with you, I think. Then.
Yes, but yeah, you were very angry.
I was
very
furious. Oh, and I cry when I get mad. So.
And then look out. Once she stops crying, look out.
Yeah. Then
because knives out.
But you have something to say about Tina Brown's formulating the Daily Beast into this wonderful political reporting package that wins Webby Awards.
They do.
And
they win.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I just, as a brief aside, Andrew Sullivan does feature on his Wikipedia page that he won the Weblog Award for Best Blog in 2008. If I ever get a Wikipedia page, I will feature on mine that I won the Weblog Award for Best Writer in 2008.
Yes, you did.
Which apparently counts for bupkis. After that, they discontinued the award. So it counts for nothing, except if you're, if you're.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thanks again to Wonkat for saving me.
Yeah.
For piling on the votes.
Oh, Wonkat.
Yes, I'm an award-winning blogger. I really am. I lie a lot about a lot of things, but I really did win some blogging awards over the years. And
but the guy who
haven't saved me.
Directing Tina Brown's political team.
Well, and this is my way of saying, I became peripherally aware of Howard Kurtz back when Steve Gilliard was calling him Mr. Kurtz.
Yeah.
Mr. Kurtz, the character from Heart of Darkness.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's gone. Nobody cares. He's gone. But he was replaced by.
Well, he's not gone.
He's
shifting.
He will find some other log to live under, and he will do fine. Being opinionated, as Mr. Ornstein and Mann have taught us, is a great way to terminate your career. You can be as credible and as nice and as awesome and as insider as you want for decades. And the minute you say, you know what? It's not both sides. It's not fucking both sides. Right now, at this point in history, it's the Republican Party. Boom. Exile. You're gone. You're gone. No more Sunday shows for you.
Tina Brown has on her team.
And yet, Tina Brown.
Mr. Good labels. Both sides do.
Tina Brown bragged. She said, you know, Howie Gertz and I are parting company. But don't worry. We have this awesome political team with people like Eleanor Clift. And that's great. But it's being headed by her political director, John Avlon. Now, who is John Avlon anyway? Who is this? Who is this young? On what meat does this Caesar feed that he's grown so great? Well, let me tell you, he eats centrist pie. Yeah. He started off as a speechwriter for Rudy Giuliani. And he's a perfectly fine writer. But his tendencies are he wrote a best-selling book on centrism and how centrists can save America. He wrote a book on wing nuts in which the fringe on both sides are wrecking our politics.
Not that.
And he is the founder of No Labels.
Oh, you mean Don't Call Me a Bush Voter?
That's right. The No Labels organization.
It's called Don't Call Me a Bush Voter.
That is, yes. Another one, another vanity program by rich assholes who don't want to take responsibility for the fact that it's
funded and supported George W. Bush twice.
Yeah. So if you say both sides don't do it like Mistress Mann and Ornstein did, and like certain liberal bloggers I could name who were 2008 Weblog Award winners have been saying since the day I started. I went back and looked. Literally since the week I started blogging 8 years ago, I've been saying I was blogging about David Brooks and centrism and how it's a big fucking lie and how don't you understand? Oh, my God, how can you be so blind? Blah, 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 blah. That is the kiss of death. And I was foolish enough to start off committing suicide day one.
See, that's what happened.
Career suicide day one. But if you write about how both sides, if you just both sides, oh, the both sides doing it, you end up being Tina Brown's political director working for the Daily Beast, which is awesome. So that's my little take.
Because that's what advertisers want.
That's right. They don't want to piss
anybody
off.
Anybody.
No, they want to look at... They want to blame
that way
far away.
They can sell deodorant to both sides because
and
they
then,
have to. I don't blame somebody who's got a product out there.
No, not at all.
But I do blame Tina Brown for pretending that that's journalism and is award winning, et cetera. Okay, I want to read something that Jay Rosen wrote about. Just going backwards just a little bit to what Obama said about CNN.
Oh, can I mention one thing about Jay Rosen?
Yeah,
he blocked me.
He's blocking lots of people.
He blocked me a couple of years ago. I can't figure out why. I think it was by accident or whatever.
Yeah.
But I see his retweets every now and then through second and third parties, and I shoot him a note. Then it says, no, I'm sorry. This person is no longer receiving or et cetera, et cetera. Wow. I've been blocked by by Jeffrey Goldberg.
I would say that's an oversight.
Well, I don't know. I kind of like it because it makes me centrist.
I'll let you brag about it on your podcast.
I get to brag about being, you know.
Hey, Jay Rosen, stop blocking Driftglass. All right.
No, it's Jay Rosen and Jeffrey Goldberg, which makes me a centrist, Blue Gal.
Speaking of centrism, let me get back to this. What Barack Obama said at the White House Correspondents Association dinner was about CNN. I admire their commitment to cover all sides of the story just in case one of them happens to be accurate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
And so Jay Rosen said, this is really wonderful. CNN sees itself as in the middle between left and right, MSNBC and Fox.
Yeah.
Just recently, in fact, CNN President Jeff Zucker praised the middle as the place to be. But CNN also sees itself as a great news gathering organization that is all about truth telling rather than ideology. Keeping them honest, as Anderson Cooper, face of the brand, likes to say.
Uh-huh.
Put them together and what do you have? Keep them honest, but stay in the middle, which doesn't work.
Right.
For what happens when one side is BSing more than the other? What happens when independent and honest reporting shows that these people on this side are mostly right in what they're saying, and those people on that side are distorting the case.
Yep, yep.
This is the last paragraph. CNN wants to believe, tries to believe, and I think does believe that this problem does not exist. Therefore, we have to remind them about it because it does exist.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Obama did. Cover all sides of the story just in case one of them happens to be accurate, is saying to CNN, accuracy and truth-telling will be sacrificed to your ideology, the middle.
Yes.
And I love the fact that he said the middle and both sides, that's their ideology. They can't get away from that.
And if you, first of all, absolutely true. Secondly, if you take that DNA and you put it into all kinds of different eggs, you grow all kinds of different monsters. And one of those monsters is the Obama magical thinking.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
If only he would just overcome.
Would not be so divisive.
If only he just would do some magic stuff that would make them stop hating him, then they'd like him.
Yeah. Maybe if he didn't have so much melanin in his skin, you know, he could have a drink with the Republicans in the Senate.
I'm not saying he's too black. I'm saying he doesn't reflect enough light. That's all. That's all I'm saying. I don't know how you could interpret that as racist. That's all I'm saying. And the problem is, until they leave office or until they're powerless, Ornstein and Mann, who wrote, you know, It's Worse Than You Think, and who have pretty much sacrificed their career on any kind of network television or any kind of...
By saying both sides don't, which is...
By saying both sides don't, they were shunned like lepers. Mm-hmm. Or, I'm sorry, Hansen's disease sufferers. They were shunned and put on a little island called NPR... And on Comedy Central, and that's the only people who will have them on, pretty much. I could be mistaken about that, but I think they were also on MSNBC at some, you know, godforsaken hour. But
I do think that both sides do it. Poison is the ricin of Washington, D.C. It is everywhere. It spreads everywhere.
It spreads
in
everywhere.
Every mailroom, it's in every envelope, and so it's gotten on everything.
And it absolutely makes or breaks your career.
Yeah.
If you want to commit career suicide on the air,
say both sides don't.
Say both sides don't. Republicans are really
Republicans
wrong.
That's the last one.
Yeah. And everyone in that room also knew that to be true. Yeah. Oh, sure, Obama can say it because he's out of a job.
He's being funny at the dinner, and we're all wearing tuxes. That's what's happening there.
And and GE can't fire him.
Yeah. Yeah.
The news director of CNN can't have him down for a little talk. He can't be scheduled out of existence. He can't be Phil Donahue'd off the air by MSNBC. We're sort of stuck with him. And as long as we can cow him into repeating David Brooks' truisms, which was true of the first three years of his presidency, we're cool.
I want to hat tip Jason on Twitter, who said David Brooks chin deep in peer reviewed policy papers.
Yeah.
And what was it? I want to get to David Brooks for a minute.
Yeah.
We have a minute to talk about David Brooks.
Okay.
Because he wrote about writing.
He did.
This week.
He wrote, he and Paul Krugman are always fighting about stuff. I just wish they'd stop makeup. It makes me
sad.
Well,
it occurs to me that David Brooks has some sort of beginning writing theme book that he's cut into strips and thrown into a jar.
Yeah.
And he just grabs one when he's feeling empty-headed. And I don't know what to write about this. I'll write about writing passionately versus writing dispassionately. Oh, that'll work.
Well, he's
not writing about writing at all.
No, he's literally writing about nothing.
Nothing. Yeah.
It's quite a talent. He spent 800 words writing about nothing. Now, just as a little bit of background, I'm not going to bore you with all the many, 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 many examples I have documented on the hundreds of essays I've written about David Brooks, where he attacks liberals, punches liberals, lies about Penn State, beats up on Harry Reid as a whining, literally sitting in a high chair crying, crybaby with a crayon, who thinks the global Illuminati beams secret instructions into George Bush's teeth because that's the only way that Harry Reid's whiny crybabiness makes sense. Mm-hmm. David Brooks actually wrote that column with pretty much all those words. And he has a long and storied history of making money, enough money to literally buy a mansion, punching hippies, lying about the past, and excoriating people who disagree with him. Mm-hmm. And now that every single thing he has ever believed in on the large scale, economically, foreign policy-wise, political, it's the future of the Republican Party as he saw it in the year 2000, deficits, surpluses, everything has failed.
He wants people to write without emotion.
He wants people to stop so committed and attached and emotional in their writing. And be a lot more detached and a lot more essentially passionless. And essentially he does, in one column violates every rule I've ever heard any writing teacher ever give.
You have a lot of quotes at your blog of writers
saying,
"Write with your blood, write with your soul."
It's and his idea is, whatever you do, don't take a stand on anything.
Don't be emotional.
You should have
your writing.
You should have a belief system, but the engaged writer, Paul Krugman, you know, is part of a tribe, and you know, it's really hard for them to take on their own people. And yeah, you'll get a job at a think tank, and you won't live under a bridge and eat beans, but it's really not the way to go. The way to go is to be detached, not really believe in anything, and kind of just, you know, let the truth take you where you will. Recognize that most everybody's right about some stuff, and everything's sort of in the middle, and it's not being squishy. But and he wrote a whole column that was just air, just bullshit air, and. Again, this is David Brooks running away from his own past. And the reason he will get rid of it, he will get away with it. I have no illusion that David Brooks ever reads me or ever reads anyone. And this,
although we're beginning to think Lawrence O'Donnell listens to his show.
He might very well read me. and more and more, it is clear to me that I am possibly the only person in media. And believe me, this podcast is about as far to the edge of media as you can possibly get.
Yes, but we love our listeners.
We love our listeners to death. But I am quite possibly the only person in media who actually ever reads the stuff David Brooks actually wrote.
Hmm.
Going back 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years.
Oh, ago. Yeah. In a historical context, yeah.
Nobody actually reads what this fucker wrote a year ago.
Yeah.
Oh, David Brooks said something about writing, isn't that? And you go through Twitter and you go through the blogs and David Brooks nails it. David Brooks did a good job. My God, what a great guy he is. And it's just hundreds and hundreds of cloying accolades. My point is not that he's a terrible writer, which he is. My point is not that he's wrong and lying about his past and making shit up and rewriting history, because he is. My point is that I could be doing all this about myself, too. But I would get away with it for about a minute because I don't have an entire army of friends who cover my ass.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have David Gregory. I don't have Mark Shields. I don't have the entire staff at the New York Times. I don't have NPR. I don't have all of the lecture halls where I make sure the audience can't ask any embarrassing questions. I don't have a phalanx of professional friends and colleagues, all of whom depend on me, all of whom have lashed their destinies to mine, who will absolutely never ask me about the bullshit I wrote yesterday.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen. And that's why he gets away with it, because there's no professional upside for anyone to pull a David Brooks column out from 2005, 2002, 2007 and say, but what you just said, here's what you wrote 2 years ago. And what you just said directly contradicts what you just said. What you wrote directly violates the rules you just laid down that everyone else should be following. How do you reconcile the fact of your past misdeeds and crimes and lies that you've never apologized for or even addressed with what you just said today? Not a single fucking human being in the first tier of American media will ask David Brooks that simple fucking question. And that, to me, says more about how broken our political system is than some state legislator who's a dick saying, I Jewed him down. There is this one abstract writer without a name or without an identity or a past attached to this one abstract idea of writing with no evidence or links or examples. And there's this other abstract person attached to this other abstract concept that's completely artificial that I just made up. And it's just, it's air. It's nothing. There's no meat to it at all. But what he does say at the end of his advice is essentially, if you're a young writer, you should drain as much life and passion out of your writing as possible and become as bland and as tepid and as clammy and as obsequious as David Brooks. And then you'll succeed.
Well, that was what someone else said on Twitter, was he makes a compelling case for writing more like David Brooks.
Yes. The army of people on Twitter and in emails who think he's doing a great job, and important people who run banks, people who are members of foreign governments, who take the time during their busy day, if you look through his Twitter timeline, to say, man, that David Brooks really nailed it this time.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of people on Twitter saying, best thing he ever wrote.
Yep. And so I have no illusion about the size of that which I'm pushing against. But,
you know, David Brooks did say that Michelle Malkin was a loon. He did say, he did come out and say that. But we want to congratulate Michelle Malkin.
Yeah.
She's the winner of this year's Andrew Breitbart Award for Journalism from the Heritage Foundation.
Man.
I can't say that without laughing.
No.
It is the perfect circle jerk.
It is.
It's just so perfect.
Well, it's
Michelle Malkin. Let me say that again without laughing if I can. Michelle Malkin won this year's 2013 Andrew Breitbart Award for Journalism from the Heritage Foundation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That really is the final brick in the wall. That really is.
It is.
The final coat of paint on the completely alternate universe in which they now live. And that's why the whole idea of engaging politically with those people is hilarious to me. They don't live on the same planet you and I live on anymore. The people who do still live here are the centrists who try to keep us tethered together.
Both sides. You know, Michelle Malkin and Driftglass.
That's right.
All right. I want to do a shout out. Several people on Twitter let me know that there is a horse in this weekend's Kentucky Derby named Fear the Kitten.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And I also want to do a very loving shout out to a writer and all around great woman over at Crooks and Liars. She goes by the name Nani Mouse. And she did a wonderful post yesterday about her battle with cancer. And we are praying for her and love her to death. And she's just an awesome person. And we just care so much about her. So
hey, Nani.
Go read that. Go read that if you can. It's over at Crooks and Liars. Nani, it's called The Mouse Has Cancer is the name of the post. And it's well worth reading because it's hopeful and very well written. And lots of people sent love to her in comments, which helped her a lot. So thank you for doing that. I want to read a letter.
Yeah, please.
That came into us a couple days ago, from our friend Carter. And Carter, I'd love to read the whole letter, but I'm going to read just a couple sentences of it because we're running out of time. Carter writes, I wanted you to know I took a few weeks away from the podcast because sometimes it all gets to be a little much.
Yeah.
I did the same thing a few years ago with global climate change reporting. It got to be absolutely despair-inducing, and that's not healthy. He also says the fight now is against nihilism. In some ways, it's always been, but now it seems more dire, like the forces of burn it all down are closing in from several sides.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to respond to that and say that we really hope that this show is protection for you and support for you and recognizing, I'm talking to our listeners here, you're not alone. You're not a little blue dot in a big, huge red sea that's drowning you. You're with us. And feel that way. We feel that way about you. But do feel free to protect yourself. May is gardening month. A lot of people go out in the garden. And just make sure the way I look at it, and Driftglass will attest to this.
I certainly will.
I make sure that I retain the ability to laugh and cry. Because depression isn't sadness. Depression is hopelessness.
Mm-hmm.
If it's fine to be raging, it's fine to be upset, it's fine to cry, it's fine to be mad as hell and scream at your television and nod at the podcast and write us and support us and all that good stuff, but don't lose hope. And if you feel that you're being dragged under, take a break.
Yeah.
So,
and if I can make one small addition to this, it's since I was going through my posts from literally the first week or two of writing 8 years ago, I ran across one. This is not a new development. Don't feel like this is suddenly rushing on you.
Yeah.
There is a cottage industry, or at least a passionate phalanx of the internet, who live to tell you that everything is hopeless.
Yep.
And in April of 2005, I was writing about, you know, a post called Resistance is Futile.
Uh-huh.
Lay down and die now and beat the holiday rush. You know these people and their sad bastard song.
Well, because they think it makes them sound intelligent.
And the question is, these are people who, for seemingly inexplicable reasons, are so deeply invested in spreading the gospel of hopelessness and despair.
And gloom.
They will literally go long miles on a dark night out of their way to find a little bungalow with cheery people gathered around talking to piss on them.
Yeah.
Hey, look, here's a sign of hope. Fuck you. We're all doomed.
Mm-hmm.
And those people, you know, I think I mentioned why don't you just go off and jerk off into a pickle jar? I think I mentioned that that's what. But it's, you know, these ennui university cheerleaders are just there, and they're like moss in the damp dark. They grow, and they're always there. They come out when you're feeling slightly hopeful and tell you, fuck you, everything's awful, everyone's corrupt, we're all doomed. Whenever you show a sign of sadness or a sign of, you know, maybe you're having a crisis of conscience or maybe you're having some doubt, legitimate doubt. And this is not to say that you should be a sunny cheerleader all the time. But, you know, what they detect, the tear coming down your cheek from a million miles away and zoom in to say, you're right, dude, it is hopeless. Fuck it, man. They're all screwed. And they usually have something to sell you.
Yeah.
They usually have like libertarianism to sell you or some cult nihilism to sell you. Or nihilism.
Nihilism sells to some people. It really.
But they always have that and they never give up.
Yeah.
And why they don't just go in the basement and end it all, I don't know.
Because they know that tomorrow is another sales day for their.
Exactly. So don't give up. Don't give in.
And they really are getting off on being superior to everybody because they know the quote unquote truth about a bad.
And misery loves company and they love spreading their contagion, which is not to say things aren't bad.
Well, and it's not to make light of clinical. I mean, I have been clinically depressed after the birth of my second child and needed to go to the doctor and get help. And I'm not dismissing that either.
No.
That happens. And if you're feeling that, see a doctor, go to the ER. If you feel like you're going to hurt yourself, go to the ER. But honestly.
But look out for people.
Look out for each other and also protect yourself. That was my message there.
Yeah. If you find someone who is hysterically focused and eloquent and extraordinarily interested in making sure you feel bad, hopeless.
Walk away.
Walk away, man. Walk away.
Thanks for sharing. Keep in touch.
Bye.
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 Every week. Oh, one last thing. Last week we did sort of 50-50 Stump the Chump and political stuff. And we're not going to do that anymore.
No.
I've decided that's too much science fiction for a political show. So
it's too rich a diet.
We're going to do one letter a week or three questions, depending on how long the emails are that come in.
It's just a wafer thin mint, Blue Guy. Just a wafer thin mint.
I would like it to eat just the wafer. And so, just so you know, that was an experiment that we decided didn't work. And we've also had requests. A lot of people like Stump the Chump, and we're coming up with a new name. We've had some good suggestions that we'll be thinking about this week.
Well, my trivia, the policeman said. Things like that. A lot of good suggestions. All science fiction based,
which is really fun. So just wanted to let everyone know that. And we'll do Stump the Chump after the music today.
Yeah.
Every week we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Sophie. Sophie is a regal Siamese. And speaking of science fiction, she looks in this photo like she is sitting on the set of 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Cool.
You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service, Go Postal Union, letter on the air, unless you say otherwise.
So, Blue Gal, how are the internet kitties doing this week?
The internet kitties can't believe Pussy Riot is still in jail. Attica, Attica, Attica.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-dovey. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2013, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast. And hat tip to Gary on Twitter for reminding us about Pussy Riot.
Yeah. Still in jail.
Stump the Chump. We got a letter from, I'm going to use her initials, AR, wrote and said, Blue Gal, please give Driftglass my thanks for rekindling my interest in science fiction. I am currently reading A Canticle for Leibowitz. I've got some Isaac Asimov and Ursula K. Le Guin on deck. I know I should read the big authors to start with. Uh-huh. Asimov, Bradbury, Heinlein, Clark, etc.
Yeah, well.
And several people have asked you to do this. Can you give us a list of authors and works that you would assign in an upper division science fiction course? What, you know, that would be a really good post for you to write up top 10, your top 10 list of somebody that wants to get started or.
It sounds suspiciously like work. And
except that you type it off the top of your head.
That's true. And then
so
I get.
I, I know. When we're watching Game of Thrones this week, I'm going to put your laptop in front of you and just have you type out.
Okay. And all I'm going to do is type, all work and no play, make Lannisters fucking in. All work.
The Lannisters.
Fucking Lannisters. Man.
All right.
One off the top of my head I can unreservedly recommend.
Oh, I know who you're going to say. Go ahead.
No, you don't. Ha ha, you don't. Is Alfred Bester's The Star Is My Destination. Sure. It is a canonical work. It is terrific. I had occasion to quote from The Demolished Man today in another post about conspiracy theories, actually. It traced, you know, the conspiracy theories always sell well. The original X-Files tipped hat to Richard Matheson. Richard Matheson was the author of My Name is Legion, to which everyone who ever wrote a zombie apocalypse or vampire apocalypse story owes big debt. Very much like J. Michael Straczynski hat-tipped Alfred Bester in Babylon 5. Alfred Bester wrote a wonderful story about telepathic police. You know, for you, all you surveillance guys, Alfred Bester was writing about telepathic police 60 years ago. This is 1953. But his best work, and this is just by way of all the stuff I've been sort of scraping through today, his best work, I think, by far is not that Demolished Man isn't wonderful, is The Star Is My Destination. It's terrific. It is a terrific novel. It's an adventure novel, a space opera. It is based – I will not tell you what classic novel it is based on, but you will be able to figure it out within the first 10 pages. And it's a wonderful novel. It's full of cool ideas, brilliantly realized, and lots of ideas. Every few pages, there's another idea, another left turn, another plot twist, and it all hangs together beautifully.
All right.
So I would recommend that.
So AR writes further, I haven't read a lot of science fiction, but I really love old science fiction radio shows from the 40s and 50s. Oh, yeah. Ooh. Particularly X-1. You and I have listened to a few X-1.
We have, yeah.
And Dimension X. What is it with the letter X in those science fiction radio shows?
It sounds mysterious.
Yes, it does. Many episodes from these two programs were based on short stories published in Galaxy and Astounding Science Fiction magazines.
Yeah.
Here are five of them. Can Driftglass name the title and author of these short stories?
Oh, man. Okay.
Okay, we'll try it. During Earth's first interstellar war, a civilian transport is traveling to Earth, is captured by a spaceship piloted by a chlorine-breathing race of intelligent beings. Huh? They place two of their own on board the human spaceship. With the human passengers sequestered as prisoners of war, only a shy, mild-mannered bookkeeper is willing to make an attempt to take back control of the ship.
I have no idea. I thought for a minute it was Arena by Frederick Brown, but that's not it.
Nope. It's by Isaac Asimov.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help you in any way?
No. Isaac Asimov wrote a million short stories. Okay. So, yeah.
C, the letter C, shoot. C-H-U-T-E. C, shoot.
Nope.
All right.
Thanks for the recommendation.
You trumped that one. Trumped him on that one. All right. Stumped him on that one. Sorry. Question two. After an unsuccessful suicide attempt, a woman explains to her rescuer how she received a message from a flying saucer and her subsequent imprisonment and interrogation by a government bent on discovering that message.
Man, if I had to guess the author, I'd say Philip K. Dick.
Yeah, that does sound like a Philip K. Dick story, doesn't it? It's not. It's Ted Sturgeon.
Oh, Ted Sturgeon. Okay.
And the name of the story is A Saucer of Loneliness.
Oh, lovely title.
Lovely title. All right, question three.
0-2.
0-2. A husband looking to get away from his wife for a vacation purchases a robot duplicate of himself to take his place. This turns out to be a bad idea.
There was a story called Helen O'Loy.
Hmm. No.
I don't think that's it, though. Give me the author.
Let
me
see if Ray Bradbury.
Ray Bradbury? No, it's real familiar, though. This one really is quite familiar.
It's called Marionettes Incorporated.
Yeah. He did a few of those.
Yeah.
I think he did one for The Twilight Zone where people could replace their bodies. Yeah. And Bradbury, right. question if you haven't read Bradbury, he's a wonderful author.
He really is. Well, Fahrenheit 451 is one of my favorites.
He's lyrical, poetic. He's the guy you give your friends who don't like science fiction.
Right. Because it's just lovely books. Okay. Question four. A Logic, much like a personal computer, nicknamed Joe by Logic Repairman Ducky.
Oh, yeah. I know this one already.
Becomes sentient and ambitious.
Yep.
Joe disables filters on the tank, the mainframe computer, and begins answering inappropriate questions, like giving sex advice to small children, and tells people how to plot the perfect murder.
Yeah.
Yes. Who wrote it?
If I'm not mistaken, that's My Name is Joe by Robert Heinlein. Or Robert Heinlein. No. Or Asimov.
Nope. It's Murray Leinster.
Yeah.
Originally published under his real name, Will F. Jenkins.
What's the title?
A Logic Named Joe. You were close with
that. I would, because they made that into a episode of like the new Twilight Zone. Okay. And the gist was, man, I really screwed up the author, but I think at least the episode I think was called My Name is Joe. And it was the idea that sentience is not a function of your higher aspirations.
Mm-hmm.
Things you can judge sentience by the ability, by the willingness of the creature to do anything to survive. Lie, cheat, steal, throw other people on landmines, do all sorts of terribly amoral things to survive. That proves they're intelligent.
Ah.
Which I thought was a lovely idea.
That is a lovely idea. All right. Last one. Question 5. A New York City jet bus driver is obsessed with killing a friend. To treat his homicidal mania, he buys a home computer psychotherapist. But the salesman sells him a psychotherapist programmed to treat Martians, not Earthlings. Well, that sounds like a good story, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Do you know the...
No.
It's by Robert Sheckley.
Uh-huh.
It's called Bad Medicine.
That one I should know.
You should know that. You should have known all of those.
I should have.
You didn't know any of them.
I feel terrible.
So thank you, AR, for stumping.
Stumped the hell out of me.
And those are all... I'm going to forward this email to him now so that he can go find these stories and read them because I know he wants to.
Great.
I know you want to do that. Sounds that like... doesn't sound like work.
No.
What, another Ray Bradbury story to read? Really? Do I have to? Well, thank you, Driftglass. I do have to get going now. I'm volunteering at one of the kids' schools this afternoon. So.
Okay. I suppose you can go. I'm looking up a logic named Joe.
I was looking that up too.
I'm trying to be right about this. And my brain told me, no, there is a Robert Heinlein story that has a robot that becomes sentient and becomes amoral and is named Joe in it. And that's the story my brain kept telling me.
So you had to go look that up and find out.
So in a desperate effort to prove that I'm not 100% wrong, because, you know, that's me. In fact, I did remember such a story that it does exist. It's a story called Jerry Was a Man, which was written by Robert Heinlein in 1947.
Wow.
And was shot for television in the Masters of Science Fiction television series, the short-lived, not very good, Masters of Science Fiction series in 2007. They tried. They didn't do a great job. But it was the story of anthropoid workers, which were essentially mechanical, biomechanical robot / genetically engineered slaves who were used by people for various reasons and then recycled as dog food once they're done, once they've been used up. And the nickname for these creatures in the story were called Joes.
Ah.
And this one Joe named Jerry demonstrates sentience, and he's put on trial, and his lawyer proves that he is more human than not by the fact that he's willing to lie and willing to sacrifice other robots.
Yes, he has evil tendencies, self-preservation
and willing to lie. Yeah. So what's more human than lying and self-preservation, which is an interesting moral for the story. But there is, in fact, such a story, and I did remember it. I conflated a lot of different things, but, you know, I'm an old man. I do things like that. Anyways, good question. I just didn't remember the right story. Got to have the last word. Although my sound editor makes sure that that's not always true.
Okay.